Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. Episode 248, The Eagle and the Four Hawks, The Making of an Inevitable War. So Bartel Frere's ultimatum to the Tshwayo Kampani was going to expire on the 11th of January, 1879. Last episode, I explained the reasons behind Frere's fevered decision, egged on as he was by Sir Theophilus Shepston, whose shadow looms large over the history of Natal and South Africa. Cetshwayo's diplomacy had relied on the British supporting him against the claims of the Boers to his territory to the northwest. Already a volatile region by Mpande's reign, now it was going to set off one of the most unique wars of the colonial period. The Boers, the Swazi, the Zulu all claimed this zone, rich as it was in reddish deep soil around Pongola, Ntombe, and Mkondo. Beautiful territory too, it must be said, the deep riverine bush, open plains between flat-topped high mountains. In summer it's warm, in winter waterless, cold. The Zulu relied on seasonally moving their cattle up to these highlands in spring and down to lower reaches of the hills in autumn. The Swazi would do the same if they could. However, the conflict over this land extended way back before the Boers rolled onto the landscape. Because the disputed territory is so far north, Natal authorities found it impossible to control any movement here. And as you heard last episode, their Border Commission report ruled that the land belonged to the Zulu and that the Boers had no legal status. But Shepston, who was now administrator of the annexed Transvaal, wanted to curry favour with the Boers, and Frere wanted the various colonies and republics of South Africa to form a confederation. Cetshwayo was standing in his way, along with Petty Chief Sekhukhune. The last Eastern Cape frontier war had ended. The Amaxhosa were thought of as a defeated nation, while by now the British also regarded the Basutu as benign, so the industrialized military might of the British Empire swiveled increasingly towards Zululand. Cetshwayo had been walking a delicate line through the 1870s, frustrated internally by having no glorious campaign to prove he'd bloodied his men in a fantastic war, although defeating the Swazi sort of by seizing a few mountain fortresses in the Lebombo Range. These were on the margins of the Boer and Swazi. It was where Zibebu of the Nyawo lived. It was also where Dingaan had died, if you recall, so the capture of the territory was a feather in Cetshwayo's cap. While Cetshwayo brooded about his northern reaches, it was the murder of two Zulu women I mentioned last episode that was seized upon by the Natal authorities as part of the many pretexts to go to war. The northern reaches were unstable, no doubt about that. Cetshwayo had been trying to succeed where his ancestors had failed in defeating the Swazi once and for all. The Transvaal was schmoozing the Swazi king because they wanted to secure the east of their territory in order to build a railway line to Delagoa Bay, thus bypassing Durban and the accursed English. At first, the Boers of the Transvaal thought of negotiating with Cetshwayo for land, but it became clear that the Zulu king would rather maintain control. His population was expanding, and they needed prime real estate for their herds. The accursed English were cursing both the Boers and the Zulu. By 1878, there were 1,352 Boers living around the Utrecht district. Only 375 were men. Despite these tiny numbers, unbelievably, there was no free land here to be had. In these times, farms of 3,000 or even 6,000 acres were regarded as the norm, allowing cattle to roam free for kilometres, munching on the sweet grass and sipping on the streams. The Boers then began encroaching on the Ngomi River, Blood River, and down into Zululand. They had moved into Wakkerstroom in 1853, the area north of Utrecht, which both the Zulu and the Swazi regarded as their marching area. It was no man's land for the African chiefs, but for the Boers, paradise. Wakkerstroom featured in the Transvaal's plans for a railway line, and the local Boers built up a close working relationship with the Swazi, spilling over further east into Pongola. Precisely where Cetshwayo was focusing, a head-on collision politically and militarily. By 1876, the Boers had claimed land to the south of the Pongola River, and began levying taxes on Zulu living there. Previous Zulu kings had claimed all the land south of a line running from the source of the Imzinyati River, the Buffalo River, and the Drakensberg along the watershed and tributaries to the Mkondo River. All African clans living in this zone were paying tribute to Cetshwayo. And in Zulu law, all land occupied by people who owned allegiance to their chief was their land. That was the African way. But the British and Boers were thinking like Europeans. The concept of title deed, land surveying, lines on a map stored in some safe far away. Since the days of Shaka, however, AmaZulu had turned land and power and marriage into an exclusively military system. Whatever the critique now is of colonial action, the reality is the Zulu could only grow power through the shaft of a spear, or by 1878 through the access of barrels of guns. Their system was suited to a moment in time, and Cetshwayo and his people were tussling with changing times. An anachronistic society facing an innovating enemy. Cetshwayo was well aware of the value of firearms and horses. By 1878, there were 20,000 muskets in Zululand, but these were used like a throwing spear, and the stabbing spear was still the preferred method of dispatching your opponent. The stabbing was the principle of washing the spear, soaking it in your enemy's blood, thus entering the hallowed portal of manhood. If your regiment did enough washing, then the king would announce that the Amabutu had permission to marry, and a man could don a head ring. So in a sense, successfully wielding a spear led directly to a sanctioned marriage and the ability to create sons and daughters. The spear was a symbol of procreation. Such a system had global resonances. The most immediate African counterpart to the Zulu Amabutu were the Maasai. Among the Maasai, young men entered the Imanyata, the warrior's village, where they lived apart from the rest of society. They guarded the cattle, raided rivals, and could not marry until their age set was formally retired by elders. The spear was both weapon and symbol. A man was measured how he used it, and blood was its sanctifying agent. Like the Zulu, the Maasai viewed warfare not as chaos, but as a necessary pulse of life, bound by ceremony and control. In Sparta, warfare was the highest civic duty. The love of the state replaced love of self. The agogi training system forged men through hunger, endurance, and communal obedience. Marriage was restricted until after service. Only those who fought well enough could become citizens, ditto the Zulu. Where the Zulu king controlled marriage through victory, the Spartan state controlled citizenship through endurance. Both made manhood conditional upon courage. Among the Aztecs, the battlefield was a sacred theater. Warriors sought not to kill but to capture enemies for sacrifice. Blood as currency with the gods. Advancement came through bravery, and with it the right to marry, to wear special clothing, to dine in the king's palace. In Zululand and Tenochtitlan alike, the spilling of blood was not mere violence but a cosmic transaction, life renewed through ritual death. Genghis Khan's armies replaced tribal divisions with military brotherhoods, 10-man units bound by shared oaths. Loyalty to the Khan superseded kingship, and warriors were rewarded with marriage alliances, loot, land. The horse replaced the Zulu spear, but discipline and ritual purity before and after battle were identical in spirit. The Mongols turned the nomadic steppe into a war machine, as the Zulu did the rolling grasslands of KwaZulu, both transforming mobility into empire. But all of these were overtaken by a more modern state, or the machinery of empire and the pressure of time. The Spartans lost their supremacy after Leuctra in 371 BC, their military culture fading under Macedonian and then Roman rule. The Aztec Empire was obliterated by the Spanish conquest of 1521. The Mongol Empire fractured within a century of Genghis Khan's death, its unity dissolved into regional khanates. The Maasai, though not annihilated, were drawn into colonial boundaries, confined to reserves, and stripped of much of their cattle wealth. Their moran system survived, but was transformed from a living military order into a cultural identity. In the homesteads of Zululand in 1878, as the build-up to war took place, the senior commanders and chiefs were aware that the tide of colonialism was washing up against their military system. It was in terms of tactics that the coming war would be the greatest undoing of the Zulu system. They had 20,000 firearms, mostly outdated but still deadly, and yet only a few dozen warriors were going to use these tools of politics properly by becoming accurate snipers. The rest of the Amabutu would fire a shot, drop the musket, and then charge into battle full frontal with their stabbing spear, just like their ancestors had done. That was the honorable way to fight, not lying a couple of hundred meters away, peppering men you can hardly see with little round lead musket balls. By charging and dignified your opponent with the option of fighting face to face, it was a code by which the AmaZulu lived. Honorably, hand to hand, let the best man win. But it was an archaic tactic in the late 19th century as firearms became more and more deadly and the rate of fire a flood. The ultimatum sent by the British included a demand that Mehlo Kazulu, or the Kungebe, along with his father Sihayo, should be handed over for dragging two of the chief's unfaithful wives over to the Zululand side of the Umzinyathi River to be clubbed to death. One was pregnant with a child that wasn't Sihayo's. They had been hiding in the home of a Zulu border policeman who could not defend them against 200 warriors who pitched up to conduct the murders. Mehlo Kazulu carried a firearm and was riding a horse, reinforcing the position as chief's son. Cetshwayo could not hand the chief and his son over to the British. It was part of the chief's right to deal with his unfaithful wife, albeit at the most inopportune moment for the Zulu people. Settler opinion was outraged. The Natal government bristled at the crossing over at the border. Chiefs along the lower Tugela River and near Rorke's Drift then organized a traditional hunt. By all accounts, far more warriors than usual took part, heightening the growing sense of unease in Natal. Then the manhandling of two British surveyors below Kraanskop by the Zulu inflamed passions, mostly because they were stripped and had their tobacco looted by the Amabutu, forced to walk home in torn and dirty long johns, like Lee Marvin growling, "I was born under a wandering star," in the movie Paint Your Wagon. Then, more seriously, there were Cetshwayo's threats against German-speaking settlers of Hermannsburg Mission Station in the Pongola region. They had moved there with permission from Zulu King Mpande in 1869, and Cetshwayo regretted his father's decision. So as you can see, the disputed territory was a violent place, chaotic, not helped by the fact that a bandit robber called Mbilini Kamswati had installed himself in the caves of the Upper Pongola River and was raiding both the Swazis and the Boers on behalf of the Zulu king. Mbilini was a Swazi prince who lost the succession dispute and fled south to Pongola in 1866, a useful loose cannon for Cetshwayo, who turned a blind eye to the bandits' actions. It should be apparent to anyone that the invasion of the Zulu kingdom was on the cards for some time. There was no chance for peace. With all the guns and social militarization and geopolitical froth flying about, the most probable outcome to all of this, in a kind of resigned way, inevitably was death. According to Zulu oral tradition, all of this was preordained. During midwinter, in the final week of July 1878, a large eagle had been spotted soaring over Cetshwayo's great place, Undini. When this noble bird was set upon by four far smaller hawks, forcing it to flee. This did not bode well. Cetshwayo's Izangoma told the king it was a sign of the four states bordering Zululand were going to combine and destroy the Zulu kingdom. Fast forward to December 11th, 1878. Sir Theophilus Shepston's brother John Shepston had met the Izinduna to negotiate the non-negotiable. It didn't help matters that John was regarded as a deployed brother of Theophilus and was to act as Native Affairs Commissioner for 8 years. He tended to mumble, a wretched public speaker. The Zulu delegation was ferried across the lower Tugela to Natal and included 14 chiefs along with 50 attendants. These were not Cetshwayo's peace party, no. None was an Isikulu with a place in the king's inner council. They included Vumandaba Kantati, who was the royal Induna and principal of the Umkhiyu regiment, Pakalani Kamdinwa, chief of the Hlangezwa, Mabilwana Kamhlanganisa of the Gingundlovu Ikanda, all related to the royal line, but none in any position to negotiate anything. The two parties met in the shade of a large awning erected under a fig tree on the banks of the Tugela close to the drift. Above them in the earth-walled Fort Pearson, an unarmed escort of 40 men from the Naval Brigade and 25 troopers from the Stanger-mounted rifles watched. I explained last episode what transpired. The Boundary Commission ruled in the Zulu favour, but then the shocking ultimatum, so I won't go over that again. The important details here are the terms which were designed to force the Zulu to go to war. They had until January 11th, 1879 to institute the terms. Cetshwayo now mustered his Amabutu, and their arrival at Kwa Nondwengu coincided with the annual Zulu First Fruits ceremony. This took place when the moon was full and about to wane in December to January. The appointed day for the gathering was 8th of January, 3 days before the ultimatum expired. Despite the danger posed by the British position, many chiefs were loath to gather. They had not completed their planting because the rains had been late. The mealies, for example, were now only expected to ripen by end February, and it was going to be a bumper crop. The younger Amabutu were hungry for action, so Cetshwayo gathered his regiments on the Mahlabatini Plain with one important new order. They were to march to the plain in their war dress, not the usual ceremonial outfits and ornaments. They had to bring their guns and ammunition. The kingdom was abuzz with word that Cetshwayo had decided the best time to act was while the moon was still young, early in January, and close to the Ukhozi First Fruits date. Cetshwayo had been toying with the idea of using his border chiefs as the kind of buffer that Xolisi facing the British at Utrecht, the Mdletshe to the east of the Ngqumbi River, Sihayo's Qungebe along the Mzinyathi River opposite Rorke's Drift, while other detachments were arrayed along the Tugela River. But his counsellors advised him to focus his army's strength, so he called all to his Ukhozi ceremony, leaving the Xolisi, Qungebe, and the Ntuli opposite Lower Tugela Drifts. The orders were not to fight, but to shadow the British as they entered Zululand, then to join up with his main army. Behind his back, Chief Hamu of the Amakhulusi was negotiating with the British, and the senior Zulu chief had indicated he would not go to war for Cetshwayo. The Amakhulusi lived in the northwestern part of Zululand, near the Nkomi or Blood River and the Utrecht district, precisely inside the disputed territory. The outcome of the negotiation was going to have a serious implication for Cetshwayo. Back at Undini, instead of the first fruit ceremony, the warriors were doctored for war in rituals, which included a Basutu Isangoma, who it was said had special powers. He doctored men's arms so that they'd shoot straight, smeared muti on their foreheads, promising the magic would weaken British bullets, rendering them harmless. 20,000 warriors slept throughout the Amakhosini Valley in early January, then visited the hallowed graves of Zulu kings where they sacrificed cattle. Some cattle were let loose in the dark. Would the shades oblige with signs of their permission? The beasts duly lowed loudly. It appeared the ancestors had granted their wish for war. Still, Cetshwayo tried one more time to sue for peace. He sent a message on Ultimatum Day, 11 January, asking for more time until the harvest was in. Lieutenant Governor Sir Henry Bulwer sent back a curt message. If Cetshwayo wanted to communicate in future, it should be with Lord Chelmsford, who was entering Zululand with his army. The commander of Her Majesty's forces in southern Africa had been preparing for the invasion for almost 6 months. Lieutenant General Lord Chelmsford believed he was facing a similar campaign to the recent Eastern Cape Frontier War, the 9th, and by the end of August 1878 he'd drawn up the outline of his invasion plan. The Xhosa had used guerrilla campaigns in the mountains, hit-and-run tactics. Eaton, educated, experienced in campaigns in India, he appeared on the surface to be an excellent choice. But dig a little deeper, and you'll find that Chelmsford, or Lieutenant General Tessica, as he was known before his father died, and he took over the mantle of Lord of Chelmsford, this soldier had been an administrator. He also loved amateur theatricals, an accomplished clarinetist. He was tall and slim, spoke in jerky sentences, dark eyes flickering under glowering eyebrows, a British gentleman, unfailingly courteous, both firm and fair to his subordinates. A teetotaler, calm under pressure. However, he was also unable to delegate and was prone to frozen vacillation. Stereotypical military tactics were his style, and as you're going to hear, he was out of his depth fighting in South African conditions. His lack of military flair was a weakness in a campaign of this scale and complexity. His plan was to send 5 columns into Zululand, a total of 18,000 men. As you'll hear, after the disaster of Zandluana, he was forced to reduce the number of columns to 3. There were 5,500 British regulars drawn from the Cape, Natal and Transvaal. Another 1,200 colonial horse colonists joined, along with nearly 10,000 black auxiliaries, all from Natal. 1,900 transport riders, suppliers, doctors, drivers, voerloopers and others would also be deployed. Chelmsford had requested Natal Lieutenant Governor Bulwer for black warriors to add to his force, but the governor refused, seeing no reason to go to war against Cetshwayo. After the coming catastrophes, he would have to relent, and more than 16,000 black warriors from Natal would be mobilized against the Zulu. Many of these refugees from the decades of Zulu civil wars itching for some justice, like the isiXhosa. Next episode, we'll join with this powerful force and spend time with the Zulu army as the juggernauts of the time are going to plow into each other. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. Head off to desmondlatham.blog. There's updates about various episodes. And you can sign up for my little newsletter or email me from there. Until next, Salagadli.